Hi, I'm Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum, founder of Barbell Medicine, and over the last 10 plus years in business, we've built a team of amazing professionals that includes physicians, physical therapists, dietitians, and strength coaches that are available to help you reach your goals. Whether it's strength and muscle gain, weight management, or recovering from an injury, we have some of the best coaches in the game and have worked with people from all walks of life. From teens to grandparents and beginners to elite level athletes, our experienced team of professionals work together to meet you where you're at and give you what you need to succeed. That's the Barbell Medicine difference. If you're not sure exactly what you need, take the quiz linked in the description below or send us an email, support@barbellmedicine.com, and we'll get you sorted. From all of us here at Barbell Medicine, we look forward to hearing from you. We'd love to help.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back to the Barbell Medicine Podcast, where we bring modern medicine to strength and conditioning and strength and conditioning to modern medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum, and this is Teaching Rounds Programming Edition. We have so many episodes on programming, honestly, like episode number 22, 23, 24, as well as like troubleshooting gains. That's another episode, progressive loading, programming update. There's a bunch of podcast episodes out there, but this is going to be a concentrated edition of our programming information in a single podcast. And we're calling it Teaching Rounds. It's a bite-sized review and summary of topics that we've covered along with updates. Future episodes starting in the year 2025 will be for our Barbell Medicine Plus members only. But we figured, hey, our standard listeners, they deserve this too. Let's put it out there. And if you want to support what we do here at Barbell Medicine, well, you know where to find us. So on the other end of the line is the second most handsome doctor in North America, Dr. Austin Baraki. What's going on, man?
Hey, excited to, you know, throw this back to the days of the programming wars. That certainly feels like a long time ago.
We both geek out on programming, even though, you know, you're like, look, there are very few papers that are going to come out. They're going to change the way that you actually program. But for a period of time there, you know, diving deep into the literature, making sense of things, and then translating that to not only professional experience, but also practical sort of takeaways. That was certainly a change in how we approach things. So totally. We're going to try to summarize that in this episode. We will have specific episodes on troubleshooting training. So like when to change things, like how long to wait before you start changing things, how to change things, stuff for beginners, specifically other special populations. So individuals, younger individuals, elderly individuals, sports training, those will all get their own summary. So this is going to be like the sort of magnus opus of our programming information. All right. You ready for this, Dr. Baraki?
Let's go.
All right. Well, let's start off with some definitions here because it's important that we're all speaking the same language and that we're all on the same page. So what is the definition of programming or an exercise program? Well, an exercise program describes all of the structured physical activity components that an individual participates in over a given period of time. By convention, that's usually a week, but you could describe somebody's exercise program over a series of weeks, over a series of months, or even for an entire training year. Now, these elements of the exercise program include exercise mode, so what you're doing, the type of exercise, the specific exercise selection, so within the mode, whether it's resistance training or conditioning training, what specific exercises are you doing, the intensity, the volume, and frequency. We'll discuss all of these thoroughly in this particular podcast. Now, even folks who aren't following a strict program, they can recall what they've done retrospectively. So there's still a program that they were doing, even if it wasn't, you know, on an Excel spreadsheet or in an app or otherwise planned ahead of time. They still followed a program. It just was more freeform. In a perfect world, the exercise program would organize the relevant training variables in a way that matches the person's goals, their current capacity, and the available resources in order to improve specific elements of fitness and, ideally, health. Now, people often confuse programming and periodization. They are not the same thing. Programming, again, is all the nuts and bolts of the actual exercise that somebody's doing on a day-to-day basis, a week-to-week basis, and a monthly basis, whereas periodization describes the planned manipulation of those variables over time to optimize performance, in some cases, health, in other cases, or ideally both together at particular time points and ultimately keep somebody progressing towards their goals and prevent stagnation. So they're kind of kissing cousins, but they are not the same thing. Does that jive with your understanding of both programming and periodization?
I think that's an appropriate primer.
All right, let's do it. So what are we programming for? Because that depends on how we manipulate some of these variables. And so there are really four major, we can call them evidence-based goals, meaning that they're not only important to sport and other sort of outlets for performance, but also for health. So the first step is going to be strength, which is defined as the amount of muscular force measured or demonstrated in a specific context. Power, well, it's closely related to strength, but incorporates how quickly the force is being produced. Hypertrophy, so that's an increase in the size and mass of existing muscle fibers. We call that hypertrophy. And cardiorespiratory fitness, or cardio, which is defined as the capacity of the heart, lungs, and circulatory system, that's the blood vessels, to sustain an activity at a particular pace. Increases in cardiorespiratory fitness improve the delivery of oxygen and energy, and also increases the removal of waste products and other related processes to maintain muscular force production during sustained efforts. So the four major evidence-based goals that we would program for and like to elicit these fitness adaptations are strength, power, hypertrophy, and cardiorespiratory fitness.
Now, I do think just I would add one thing here is that these are the big four that we have identified and prioritized, and you're calling them evidence-based insofar as there is evidence that improving these particular physical capacities relates to improvements in health, in longevity, reductions in risk of disease and death. There are certainly many other goals that can be programmed for. There are many other goals that we program for the people that we work with. And those might include very particular sporting contexts, for example, that are not going to be like, oh, this is evidence-based, going to improve your health, but that's like you want to participate in this particular sport. There are going to be unique needs that we need to program for, but most of those involve like, what are the demands of your sport in terms of strength, in terms of power, or in terms of cardiorespiratory fitness, as an example? Or I suppose even in hypertrophy, if you're a bodybuilder. So you can still frame those like sport-specific ones often in terms through the lens of these types of things. And then the other is rehabilitation, which is another goal that we program for in terms of tolerance, reduction in sensitivity or pain symptoms, and return to a previous level of physical capacity or beyond. So there's just a few other examples of other goals that we might program for, but many of them we think about through the lens of these four. It's just in a more specific way when people have more specifically defined goals.
Yep, agree. So it's nice. It's useful to have a central paradigm of like, well, how does this all work? How does the program generate these adaptations, these goals? Like, how's that all related? And the sort of model that we like to use is called the fitness fatigue model, wherein the training produces both fitness and fatigue. And there are a few other terms that we'll use in here. So first is going to be stimulus or training stimulus. This is what's applied to an individual. It's effectively the nuts and bolts of the program. It's the sum of all exercise activity performed by the individual, which is defined by, again, the specific programming components. So exercise selection, intensity, volume, rest periods, velocity of movement, range of motion, and so on. The total of exercise performed by the individual in a given period of time, and by convention that's a week, is also sometimes called the external load, but that's all training stimulus. Okay, so that's what's applied to the individual. On the other side of that is training stress. This is what is experienced by the person based on their current level of fitness, their current performance potential, their mood, the environment, their expectations, the current fatigue status, nutritional status, genetics, and every other factor that makes them a unique biological organism. Two people are likely to experience a different training stress from the exact same training stimulus. So they did the same workout, the same program, but they're going to experience that in different ways because they are different individuals, unless they're identical twins that have been sharing the same environment for a long period of time. Training stress is sometimes also called the internal load and can be measured by things like heart rate changes in response to exercise, the rate of perceived exertion, exercise session that'd be called a session RPE, repetitions in reserve can also be used, and changes in movement velocity. Okay, so you have the training stimulus, that's the actual nuts and bolts of the program. That gets applied to the individual. The individual does that workout or series of workouts. They experience that as training stress, and ultimately training stress leads to both fitness adaptations and fatigue. But I want to stop right there and talk about this idea about productive versus non-productive training stress. And so when I think about productive training stress, my definition for that is that it increases fitness adaptations. By definition, that would be a productive training stress, whereas non-productive, also sometimes called non-functional sort of training stress, would be something that doesn't increase fitness adaptations. That's relatively rare and tends to be more associated with a measurement, either absence or measurement error, meaning that you have somebody doing a particular type of exercise program and you test them in such a way where it does not capture any of those fitness adaptations. It's very rare that somebody's doing planned exercise over a long period of time and doesn't improve in any sort of factor. But if you're only measuring an unrelated thing that they're not training for, you may say, well, look, this is non-productive training stress because you didn't test them. So for example, if you have somebody who's doing a lot of heavy resistance training, a lot of single rep efforts, a lot of near maximal training, whatever, for squat, bench, and deadlift, but then you test their VO2 max at the end of a 12-week program, it's probable that it might, it won't go up unless their VO2 max was really low to start out with. And so you could conclude that, hey, that was non-productive training stress. But the thing is, you're just measuring the wrong thing, or you didn't give enough time for that to play out. That's another way that there's sort of measurement error involved. And so I really don't like discussing like non-productive, you know, training versus productive training, because I think it really matters how you're testing these things. And if you're not testing everything, it's highly likely you're missing something.
Yeah, the other thing that I would challenge here is just a binary view of it. I think that that binary view is applicable if you're testing very different divergent adaptations, like you said, a one rep max deadlift versus like somebody's VO2 max. Then it would break down to be pretty neat in terms of yes, no, productive, non-productive type stuff, right? However, I think that in most contexts, we tend to think about it more as a spectrum. The bang for your buck that you get from training, the most productive training that you get, that you do, is going to be like the first working set that you do. And then from there, of course, as with anything else, you get diminishing returns. Now, the returns you get will continue to increase for a while from training volume in both the strength training world and in aerobic training. You can continue to get additional adaptations up to quite high training volumes, but no one should be under the illusion, of course, that you're just getting like a linear improvement in adaptations or performance as the volume goes up. Of course, there's diminishing returns to that. And so you could argue that my most productive training is the stuff, you know, at the lower doses, and it just the productivity of each set, the kind of the marginal return on that is going to diminish. And so the decision of how much training volume should I do is going to be impacted by like, how important are these gains to you and how much work are you willing to do to get them? For some people, for general health purposes, they probably don't need to do an enormous amount of training volume to get, you know, the majority of health benefits that there are to be had. But if you want to optimize your performance and compete at a high level in a sport, you are not going to get by in most sports with very, very low, you know, training volume in most situations, because the people who are going to beat you are probably doing more.
Yeah. Yeah, the gains per set, we could use that as like a measurement tool. It's going to tend to decrease, or like gains per mile for like conditioning type stuff. Gains per minute is going to tend to decrease as you go out and further and further and further. At some point, it will stop. But that's way beyond what most people are likely to do in a single session or even a series of sessions, honestly. And so this idea, oh, that's just, you know, junk volume or like non-productive sort of stuff. It's like, I think you're either measuring the wrong thing, or your measurement point is inadequate to capture all of these fitness adaptations.
Yeah.
Okay. Which, speaking of, let's talk about fitness adaptations. What are they? Well, these are the positive exercise-induced changes in the human organism, such as things like muscular strength, muscular hypertrophy, cardiorespiratory fitness, work capacity, so the ability to tolerate and perform higher volumes of activity. Cognitive performance would be a type of fitness adaptation, although you could make the argument that it's a health adaptation. And in fact, I lump the two things together. I view, it's hard to view like fitness and health as binary, like, oh, it's either all fitness or all health. So, and again, we see multiple lines of evidence where there's some overlap. As people become fitter, these other markers of health tend to go up. And so I think they tend to be related. I just call them fitness adaptations, but if somebody wanted to call them fitness and health adaptations as the positive exercise-induced changes in the human organism, I'd be on board with that. Any pushback from that?
No, fine.
All right. So then the other thing that training stress generates, in addition to fitness adaptations, is fatigue, which is represented by the subjective experience of negative exercise-induced changes in the individual, so things like muscular soreness, muscle damage, reduced force production, tiredness, etc. There's a specific type of fatigue. We can call that task failure. It's like this short-term version of fatigue. So you're doing a set of squats, for example, at like 75% of your one rep max, which is about a 12 to 15 RM rep max for most folks. And you get, you know, fatigued at the end. You take it all the way to failure. Yep, that's task failure. That is a version of fatigue that's occurring during the set, intra workout. But after some period of time, you've, you know, restored your ability to squat that weight again, for example, perhaps for another 12 to 15 reps. Okay. But are you still carrying fatigue? Something is going on. Something's in the ether. Because if the next day you were, you know, teed up to squat a one rep max, you probably wouldn't want to do that workout because of this sort of longer lasting fatigue, which admittedly is a black box. When people start to talk about fatigue, I'm like, what definition are you actually using? And so I am intentionally broad when talking about fatigue. It's this sort of negative, subjective experience that people have after exercise, and it can include things like soreness, reduced force production, tiredness, and so on. It's harder to measure, especially consistently, because if we're just talking about reductions in force production, like how long does that go out, for example, and that's going to be specific to the workout and how you're testing force production. So there's muscle fatigability, like, you know, how continuously can you produce maximal force? That's just one type or one element of fatigue, but it's admittedly a black box. And I think if we had a fatigue episode, we'd have to bring in some additional expertise on this, but those folks also kind of throw up their hands and are like, well, there's a lot to the story. Does that jive with your experience?
Yeah, I think that for the purposes of a summary teaching rounds episode where we're getting people to understand the basics of programming, fatigue can be a I know it when I feel it kind of phenomenon.
There you go. Justice Potter has entered the chat. So again, this overall thing here is that the training stimulus is this sort of neutral program, exercise session, series of exercise sessions, all the nuts and bolts of the exercise program, sets, reps, exercise selection, rest periods, et cetera, that gets applied to the individual. The way they experience it is called the training stress. Internal load, you can measure that, heart rate, change in response to exercise, reps in reserve, RPE, bar velocity, movement velocity, and so on. And that experienced sort of training stimulus, which again we call it training stress, drives both fitness and fatigue. So positive sort of adaptations and also sort of negative experience. That would be fatigue. Recovery, as a sort of last definition, represents the shift in balance and the amount of positive changes, fitness adaptations, and the amount of negative sort of experience, the fatigue. As this, you know, you shift the balance to more and more positive adaptations and less fatigue, performance potential likely goes up. Recovery is heavily influenced by genetics, heavily influenced by training history. The more trained you are, you tend to recover faster, get back to either baseline level of performance or higher level of performance, nutrition status, sleep quality and quantity, and all sorts of other things. External to the gym stress can play a role and environmental factors, right? All of this stuff that we wrap into recovery sort of shifts the scales. Again, if you think about you have five adaptation units and five fatigue units, well, at that point, you'd be back at baseline, very neutral, right? If you had five fitness adaptation units and one fatigue unit, we would expect your performance potential goes up. Although being able to demonstrate that improvement in fitness, those fitness adaptations, depends on a lot of other different factors, right? You could have an increased VO2 max, for example, you've generated from training. But if the environment that you go to test that newfound VO2 max and fitness in is harsh, it's hot, it's humid, you're in a headwind, you woke up and you were tired. For example, your significant other broke up with you, you lost your job. Well, you may not be able to demonstrate that improvement in sort of fitness despite having it on board. Same thing with strength. If you have improved your muscles' ability to produce force, but you go into the gym, your favorite squat rack is taken, and you're on this janky sort of piece of junk equipment, and they're playing Taylor Swift, and you're not a Swiftie, well, you may not be able to PR your back squat. Me personally, I would thrive in that environment, but not everyone is like that. So again, the fitness fatigue models are sort of central paradigm for understanding how tweaking the programming variables will ultimately lead to sort of different predictable outcomes. The predictable outcomes in this case being fitness adaptations and fatigue. Measuring these things gets a little tricky when it comes to measuring fatigue, but it's a good working sort of model for understanding the changes that would happen in a person based on changing exercise variables. Anything else you want to add to that, Baraki, before we move on?
Yeah, no, I think it's a great model to think about programming in general, and it's also going to be applied on a more micro level when it comes to actually designing programs, for example, and like picking exercises that you're going to do. Like, what's the potential fitness adaptation that I'm going to get out of this exercise, or the dosage, or the way that I'm programming it relative to the amount of fatigue cost that it's going to generate for me. That's something that becomes more and more of a consideration, I think, the more advanced of a trainee you become. But it's both applied on the macro level of the program as a whole, and then also on a more micro level with like kind of more day-to-day and minor programming decisions as well. So it'll come back a little bit later.
Yep, I agree. All right, well, let's get into programming variables. I don't know if you've seen this in various exercise science publications, this sort of FIT model, F-I-T-T model for programming variables, stands for frequency, intensity, type of exercise, and time. Have you ever seen that before?
Yeah, I've seen it in some stuff around kind of the, when the idea of prescribing exercise to patients as a clinician, it's a nice acronym that they try to teach clinicians on, like, here are the variables you need to think about. Yeah.
Yeah. But I don't really love it because, one, frequency doesn't really seem to matter if we, you know, are defining frequency by like how often you're doing a particular type of exercise or whatever. It's, that's really more of a lever to change volume of exercise, which is far more important. And then, you know, because there's no sort of element of how hard are any of these efforts, right? Intensity, it refers to either weight on the bar, pace of a particular piece or something, but that doesn't tell you how close the set is taken to failure. For example, a set at 90% of your squat, well, you could do that maybe for a triple, a 3-rep max, which would be maximal, or you could do it for one. And so intensity is kind of like, look, there needs to be more stuff in there. So I came up with the longer acronym. It's a work in progress. I don't know if I'm going to like commit myself to using this acronym going forward, but so far I kind of like it. It's the WATER acronym, WATER, W-A-T-E-R, WATER. W stands for weight, so intensity. A stands for amount or volume. T stands for type, so the exercise selection and mode of exercise. E stands for effort, and R stands for regulation. How are you regulating these things? Are you using RPE? Are you using reps in reserve? Are you using bar velocity? Are you using heart rate data? Are you using some sort of linear progression where things are discretely programmed, you know, weeks to months in advance, where you're just going to add 5 pounds in perpetuity until you're the world champion powerlifter? Any different models. Austin, what do you think about my WATER model?
I was just looking at it as a as an anagram and seeing what other words I could generate from it. And there wasn't a ton coming up off the top of my head. So we'll have to go with this for now.
Yeah, I spent some time thinking about this. First, it was teal, and then I switched it to WATER. Like, we'll see. Maybe there's some opportunities there. So let's talk about each one of these variables, and then we'll dive into how to manipulate these things. So first is going to be the W. That's weight or intensity. And this describes the relationship between a specific effort and an individual's previous best performance on that task. In resistance training, intensity refers to the weight used for an exercise, typically listed as a percentage of one rep max. And in conditioning, intensity is typically discussed as a pace or distance. For example, run 1 mile at a seven minute pace. The phrase 7 minutes in that is the intensity. Amount is the A that refers to volume, which is the amount of work completed in a given time period. By convention, the most commonly discussed time periods are training sessions, training weeks, or training cycles. The latter can last weeks to months on average. In resistance training, volume is defined as the number of repetitions performed for a given movement or a given workout or series of workouts. It is the product of total repetitions and sets completed. And in conditioning, volume can be defined by durations like time, also mileage, or a similar metric. It's basically telling you the amount of things, of exercise that you're doing. Frequency, I kind of lump in here as well because this describes the number of training sessions performed per exercise, per muscle group, or other specific activity. So how many times you run, for example. And again, by convention, this is a week. And it's just another way to either spread out the volume and the training efforts, or otherwise change the training volume. The type, so this is the T in WATER, refers to exercise selection and mode. So exercise mode or modality is defined as the type or category of exercise performed. There are two primary modes of exercise, resistance training and conditioning. The second thing under type is exercise selection, and this can be defined as the specific exercise or movement performed by the individual and their specifics, such as range of motion, tempo, and other specified aspects of the movement pertaining to the setup or completion of the task. The last one is effort and regulations. So this is the ER part of WATER. So again, we can use tools like RPE, that's rating of perceived exertion, RIR, repetitions in reserve, bar velocity, heart rate changes, et cetera, to gauge the effort. RPE is one that we use quite often. It's a subjective measure of a person's exertion during or after a task. And perceived exertion refers to how hard the task feels. How hard was the effort you just did? This should be distinguished from fatigue, which refers to the subjective feelings of reduced performance. So really, we want to say, hey, how hard was that set? Not how fatigued are you or how tired are you? So one proxy we use for RPE is repetitions in reserve. How many reps do you have left in the tank? During cardiorespiratory fitness activity, so cardio, it could be how breathless are you, for example. So there are a number of different proxies you can use to gauge how hard it is. And that speaks to this sort of bigger point, this proximity to failure. So how close are you to maximal or failure or your best performance, for example? So this is a more sort of nuanced take on intensity, because intensity really is just the load or the pace. But how hard that is relative to your performance potential is more indicative of the training stress that somebody is going to experience. So we need to have this. And that last bit on regulation, you can regulate the effort that somebody is allowed to do in a given training session in a number of different ways. We prefer things where the person doing the activity, doing the task, actually participates in rating how hard the thing was, rather than just writing a number on the piece of paper and say, yeah, just do this weight. Because what if it was really easy? Is that capturing the essence of the workout? Is that fitting the goals of the workout? Or on the other hand, if it says, hey, do five reps at, you know, 10 pounds heavier than what you did last week, and they were only able to do three. Well, obviously, there was not enough regulation there, and the person missed the sort of goal of the workout. They went too heavy, could not complete the task as programmed. And so that is an opportunity to improve the sort of training stress and subsequently the fitness adaptations a person gets from a training session. We think that by using some sort of regulation that allows people options to either increase the intensity, increase the load that they're lifting, increase the repetitions, or alternatively decrease any of those variables, we're able to sort of meet them where they're at on a given day. And we can do that pretty easily without a bunch of advanced sort of diagnostic or testing or otherwise inconvenient sort of options. Austin, do you like that sort of that framing of effort and regulation?
Yeah, I think that it adds to kind of more traditional programming variables that people throw around a ton and pay a lot of attention to, of what exercises and the volume and intensity. But adding on this proximity to failure by way of effort and then regulating, incorporating that into like the foundational model, I think expands and is more in line with how we think about things and recommend it for people.
All right. So through all of those things, this WATER acronym that sort of invented, the goal of proper programming is to match the training stimulus and the stress experienced by the individual to the person where they're at that day. And we have ways to do that on, you know, at a micro level, like in a training session. You can tell how strong somebody is based on, for example, how their warmups are moving. You don't need to just go into a program and have just a number on a piece of paper and stick to the plan no matter what. If you're a little stronger, you can add a little bit more weight or do a few more reps, for example. And if you're not quite as strong on a given day, for whatever reason, you can back it down. Again, to match the sort of training to who you are that day. And things change day to day. The performance varies higher and lower day to day in humans. We think, we've kind of talked about this between us, Dr. Baraki, we're like a 5% increase or 5% decrease in strength from this sort of baseline level or average strength level is kind of within normal limits. But once it starts getting above that, we're like, oh, I actually am stronger. Neat. Or if it starts getting below that 5%, so further away, you're like, ooh, maybe I actually am detraining a little bit for whatever reason. Doesn't mean you need to sound an alarm either way. It's just kind of what I think about when determining sort of like real improvement in strength or real decrease in performance. Does that kind of jibe with your experience?
Yeah, both personal and with clients. And so the other kind of perhaps hot take that I'll insert here at this point in the podcast, because you mentioned this idea of adjusting the stimulus based on how somebody's performing on a given day, meaning accounting for life variations. If you're a little stronger, you could go a little more. If you're not feeling worse, you go a little down. We already know, because we've talked with these folks in the past that disagree with this approach and who feel that it will lead to people wasting time, for example. They won't get as fast, as strong, as fast as possible. This idea of like maximum training or programming efficiency being a fundamental principle, that the fastest you can possibly increase the weight, the fastest you can gain strength, the better. We do not agree with this approach. In fact, we think that direction of causation is actually backwards. It's not that you increase the weight super fast so you get strong. Rather, the stronger you get, the more you're able to increase the weight as a result. That's thing, my hot take one. And then number two is actually that I do not think that efficiency, quote unquote, particularly in the beginner phase of training or getting as strong as fast as possible, is necessarily a desirable thing to pursue. Everyone who trains for a long enough period of time, which is what we're advising, lifelong exercise and training career, is going to experience setbacks. And to the extent that you maybe spent one session early on as a beginner where you didn't increase the weight or you decreased it for a day because you felt really bad, compared with inexorably increasing it every session, that is likely to be outweighed by a setback way down the line where you miss a session, where you get sick for a day or a week, or you travel and you miss a few sessions, or you get an injury and you have to back way off of your training load, such that if you take two people, one who increases the weight as fast as they possibly can in the beginner phase versus another person who allows for more of this up and down kind of regulation over time, but continues to, you know, march on over a very long training career, 5 years, 10 years, 15 years later, I am unconvinced that they are likely to end up in a radically different spot by the end of that period.
Yeah, I think conceptually the way I frame it and kind of why I view your take as correct, really our take, but why I think that's more likely to be true is that because there's this range of sort of viable intensities, viable levels of hardness of given sets that are equally productive. So increasing the weight by a little bit, for example, is probably inconsequential. And in fact, when you're significantly stronger, such that keeping the weight the same, you now fall out of that range, well, you're going to know it when you feel it,
yeah,
right? And further, when you actually look at evidence on how quickly do people get stronger, demonstrable improvements with a high degree of reliability in how strength is being tested, in this case, one rep max. On average, when you look at all comers, when this has been studied, it's about 4 weeks. Now, granted, there's individual variations in that. Sometimes it's faster, sometimes it's slower. And it obviously depends on how you're testing strength. But because strength is this sort of lifelong pursuit, right? And it takes a while for those adaptations to come on board for people to be able to demonstrate that improvement. I think that there's this wide range of viable intensities that can be used to get people stronger. You don't always have to increase the weight week to week. Some people like that momentum sort of thing where they're going up week by week. And sure, if you are in fact stronger every week, go up. But the problem is when you try to force it and it becomes too hard, too stressful, such that fatigue is outpacing the fitness adaptations. At that point, you're not really getting, not only were you not stronger in the first place because it got harder, but I don't know that you're actually driving more long-term fitness adaptations anyway. Rather, I think you're creating this excess fatigue under the delusion that adding weight is should supersede all other sort of programming parameters, which doesn't make sense. Adding weight and reducing the reps, that doesn't necessarily make you stronger. You just change the goalposts. Adding weight, but making it more harder, so now it's maximal versus, you know, two or three reps shy of what would have been maximal that day, that's not an improvement in strength. You just shifted the goalposts. You changed the sort of task. Same thing. Cutting range of motion so that you can lift more weight doesn't make the exercise more effective. You just changed the task that you were doing. And so a real improvement in strength is keeping all of the variables the same: effort, range of motion, rep scheme, et cetera, and doing more weight. That is one way that you can demonstrably increase strength. Increasing strength endurance or strength stamina, for example, would be by being able to do more reps with the same weight, with the same range of motion, at the same effort level. But if it got harder, it's like you just did something different. And so as far as the utility of making it harder on yourself, that is probably where the debate lies. And we're of the opinion that it needs to be hard enough for it to work. But any harder than that is just causing excess fatigue for really no benefit from a fitness adaptation standpoint. And I think that we can use the current available evidence and experience to tell us, you know, or guide us in the right general direction, and that it needs to be tailored to the individual. Last thing I'll say about this is in medicine and other sort of applications, there is some line of thinking to correcting whatever is wrong as quickly as possible. Like we are at a race against time. So for example, with excess adiposity, excess body fat, we want people to lose the weight in a relatively quick fashion so that they're not exposed to the harms and increased risk from carrying too much body fat, meaning that we don't want a process that could have taken 6 months to take 5 years, for example. That's not really the case with a sort of strength deficit, right? You can even consider individuals with sarcopenia, right? And it's not like, look, by whatever means necessary, we need to increase your strength tomorrow. Otherwise, you're at a significantly increased risk of, you know, frailty, all-cause mortality, or whatever. It doesn't mean we want to do it slower than we could, but it we also don't necessarily need to rush the process in a way that may lead us down a road where you actually don't get that strong at the end. And the last thing I'll say about this, if it worked to force the progression, right, and just you're going up no matter what, no matter how you feel, even on days when you don't have it, if it really worked, we'd have receipts. There would be people who are following that progression who would be world beaters, world champions in strength sports. But invariably, all these people seem to kind of end up in the same sort of general space. They do training that is specific to their sport or task or otherwise way that they're testing their performance in a way that allows them to do a lot of that training. And you just can't do that, broadly speaking, if it's maximal all the time. Does that kind of make sense to you?
Yeah, I think all of this is different ways at getting at this point that we're trying to make, that we want to try to match the programming stimulus to the person, not only all the characteristics that make them unique, but where they're at on a particular day. And so allowing there to be a major difference or discrepancy between what I'm prescribing somebody and what they're actually capable of doing in a given day would be an example of poor matching and poor programming. So all of the ways that we're going to lay out that we approach this is, what are the ways that we, how do we think about this as a way to better match the programming to the person?
Yeah. Yeah. So let's talk about some of these like person specific variables. So the first one I'll bring up is their current sort of fitness level. And so people have tried to classify individuals or label individuals before, novice, intermediate, advanced, or like class one, class two, whatever, down the line, based on sort of comparisons to normative data that have been collected in various ways. I don't know how useful this is, because if somebody tells me that they're an intermediate trainee, for example, that doesn't mean anything to me. And like previous sort of like criteria that have been used to determine these like labeling systems have been like, well, if you're a novice, you can add weight every workout. If you're an intermediate, you can add weight every week. And if you're advanced, it's slower than that. And it's like, well, that doesn't work. Effectively, the first two categories then represent maybe like 6 months of people's training, right? And further, like when I've been on a roll getting ready for a meet, I'm able to add weight every week. And I'm like, am I an intermediate again? And finally, because of this sort of dynamicism between, people's progression rate and their sort of training age, as you will, it doesn't tell me how to program for somebody. Right. And I think if you look at it like labeling people's current fitness level through that lens, in addition to the idea that we're still trying to match the training load to the individual, like the label becomes completely unnecessary and not useful. I'm like, I can't tell you how I'd program somebody different if they're an intermediate, like a self-identified intermediate versus an advanced lifter. It's not enough information. Do you have a different opinion, or does that make sense to you?
Yeah, I think that it would be nice if these labels were super reliable and led to, you know, superior outcomes, because we do that all the time in medicine, for example, where I try to phenotype people. And based on this phenotype, I know that this treatment will work better and that one, the other one will work better. But that doesn't really seem to pan out, because there's way too many variables, both in terms of the inputs and the outputs of training adaptation in these situations, as well as just the ups and downs of life, that sometimes beginners are having a really rough time and they might not even be able to add weight every every session, and vice versa for more advanced trainees. So I agree that this categorization has less utility than previously advertised, I would say.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's been some thought to call people trained versus untrained. You see that in the literature all the time. You say novice versus non-novice. I think those would be reasonable. Like if someone says, look, I'm completely untrained, well, certainly that's going to tell me some things about how I would probably approach programming for them compared to somebody who says, oh, I've been training for 10 years. But that's like basically a broad categorization that still doesn't tell me exactly what to do. And I'm going to ask them the same follow-up question anyway, which is, okay, well, what's your training look like for the last few months? So the training history, to me, it becomes much more important. What have you been doing the last few months? Because that's going to tell me the kind of nitty-gritty on how to come up with a program within the context of their goals, what they want to do. Historical stuff, so way removed, like, oh, 5 years ago, I was able to squat 700 pounds. that could be useful from like a psychological standpoint. Like if that's what they're kind of anchoring to, like this is my performance level, I got to get back there. That may tell me some additional information as far as like, well, how often do I have this person squat heavy singles, for example, if I have concerns about them maybe trying to overreach a little bit too fast. But otherwise, more so the last 3 to 6 months kind of tells me what I need to know. How many sessions are you doing per week? How many sessions did you miss? What's been your sort of progression over the last few months, or regression in some cases? What sort of injuries have you been dealing with? Those aspects of training history are more germane to me actually coming up with somebody's program. And then obviously that's through the lens of their goals. So we can use those sort of evidence-based goals we listed for health. So that would be things like strength, power, muscle mass, cardiorespiratory fitness, but also their self-identified goals. Like what do they want to do, whether it's a particular task, particular performance. Those would be helpful, the training history and their goals. And then the second to last step here is going to be, and what are their preferences for going about doing that? Meaning like, what sort of exercises do they like doing? What sort of exercises do they not like doing, and why? Asking why. So if Austin was programming for me and he's like, all right, what's your training been for the last few months? And I send him my split, for example, and I tell him how I've been doing. And he's like, well, it looks like you've been doing pretty well. Any movements that you really like or you really don't like, I would just say front squats. I don't want to do them. Don't program them. I hate them. And he could just say, oh, hey, fine. Leave well enough alone, particularly if it's not important for the particular goal. But I do find as a coach, it's useful to ask people why. So if he asked me why, I'd be like, look, dude, I can't rack the thing securely. It hurts my broken collarbone that it didn't have properly repaired. So I just don't want to do it. And he's like, ah, okay, now I have a good reason. It's not just because like you had an injury, like that can be useful to know. Or if somebody's had like, look, I did this for a whole year and I had a very poor response. Those things would be useful to know from a coaching perspective.
Yeah. And sometimes the reason ends up being something that's like pretty easily remediable, right? So if it's just like a little technical thing that I can say, oh, have you tried this? And then suddenly they're like, oh yeah, that actually works great. Why don't we try this exercise? So sometimes you get a workaround, sometimes you accept it. And so not only am I assessing people's preferences at this stage, but also what are their limitations? Do they have a significant orthopedic musculoskeletal injury history that has relevance for how I might program certain movements or activities or something like that? Maybe they have, you know, long-term limitations in range of motion due to a prior injury, and that might impact, you know, what I might prescribe or kind of the standards by which I might assess their performance in training.
Yeah. And then the last part of the sort of individual specific sort of variables has to do with the response. So this is like post hoc. So after you've sort of delivered the initial batch of programming and you're sort of seeing how does this person actually respond to what I've programmed for them, not only in like actual progression. So what's their sort of adaptations been that you've been able to sort of measure, but also like, are they having fun? Right? What's their adherence level been? If you go from a person who for the last few months was diehard in the gym, I'm lifting 4 days a week, I'm doing conditioning 4 days a week or whatever, and you give them a different program as their coach, and you know, in your weekly check-ins, they're regularly missing sessions. Either there was a mismatch in like the sort of resources you're demanding from them and what they have available, or in this case, they just don't like what you've programmed. And so getting, you know, there are very few things written in stone with respect to programming. Like you have to do these exercises, you have to do these rep ranges and so on outside of barbell sports. So if somebody's not having fun and not able to adhere, you got to change something. And then, yeah, you would just want to kind of measure their response. Health responses can be useful. So waist circumference, what's that doing? Blood pressure, for example, what's that doing? Body weight, body composition. And as well as like fitness adaptations, how strong have they gotten? Have you been able to discern any other sort of improvements in strength, stamina, muscle size, cardiorespiratory fitness, or performance in some of those exercises? Just kind of continually iterating based on somebody's response. That's going to be the kind of final individual specific variation, because there is a huge variation in how people respond to exercise, a huge variation. And if you don't appreciate that, you can get stuck in this loop of just recommending the same program over and over and over again to everyone. And when it doesn't work for somebody, you just point your finger at them and say, it's your fault. You're doing something wrong. When it's more probable that the program just wasn't good for them, which is totally fine. I kind of view this, Austin, are you a Harry Potter person?
I think I read some of them when they came out as a kid, but
you familiar with the sorting hat? You familiar with the sorting hat?
Yeah, totally.
So depending on how you sort of enter the health and fitness world, particularly strength training world, you may automatically be sorted in a particular house one that maybe not, it doesn't actually suit you that well. And so if by getting sorted into one of these houses, you sort of prize particular exercises, particular rep ranges, particularly program design, whatever, you might end up doing a bunch of exercise and training and following programs that aren't just well suited to you because you got kind of sorted into the wrong house. So the real job of a coach is to give people opportunities to flourish, identify things that works really well for them. And that may be something completely different than what the coach's personal preferences are for themselves. And I've certainly had to program that a number of times. And earlier on in my career, it was harder to do because I'm like, this doesn't make sense to me. But now I almost kind of enjoy that challenge because I'm like, cool, well, I got to learn something new or I got to try something different. But that's your real job as a coach, is to give people multiple opportunities to succeed, find out which ones really align with them, and then ride that to the wheels fall off and do it all over again over time.
Yeah, I agree, except for the part where the wheels fall off, depending on what that metaphor means.
Sure. Yep. Mm-hmm. Maybe phrasing. Yeah. All right. Hey, everyone. I hope that you're enjoying the podcast. I just wanted to remind you that we have launched our Barbell Medicine Plus option in order to help support what we do here on the podcast and beyond. Now, Plus members get early access to our podcast, ad-free listening, written transcripts and summaries, videos, exclusive access to a members-only podcast where Dr. Baraki and I answer your questions directly, and more exclusive content as well. If you want to support what we're doing and become a Barbell Medicine Plus member, head over to barbellmedicine.com/plus and sign up to be a Barbell Medicine Plus member today. That's barbellmedicine.com/plus. And just think, no more of these ads. Thanks for your support. Now back to the podcast. While we all know that nutrition is huge when it comes to health and performance, we don't always have time to shop for and prepare healthy meals. The days are getting shorter, but your to-do lists aren't. So instead of reaching for your phone to order out or heading to the nearest restaurant, let Factor help you take the stress out of eating healthy this fall. Skip the grocery stores, the prep work, and the cooking fatigue, and instead get chef-crafted, dietitian-approved meals delivered right to your door. Factor lets you choose from a ton of different meal plans, including everything from vegan to high-protein options. Find guilt-free comfort foods like homestyle chicken and gravy and loaded mashed potato pork chops. Also feel-good vegan options like sweet potato and chickpea curry, and gourmet plus dishes like truffle butter filet mignon. When things get hectic, Factor is flexible. You can change your order up every week with plans from 4 to 18 meals per week, or pause or reschedule your deliveries anytime. Now, if you want a helping hand with your nutrition, head to factormeals.com/BBM50 and use code BBM50 to get 50% off. That's code BBM50 at factormeals.com/BBM50 to get 50% off. This podcast is sponsored by Incogni. Anyone who's been on the internet knows that online privacy and data protection is a big problem. Every year, both the number and severity of personal data compromise goes up. And according to the 2022 Annual Data Breach Report by Identity Theft Resource Center, the number of victims has gone up by nearly 41.5% from 2021. In the U.S. in particular, there's a big problem where people search individual websites to create detailed personal profiles on millions of Americans and publish them online for anyone to see. The bad news is that your personal information is probably being sold or published online without you even knowing it. The good news is you have the right to protect your privacy and request that data brokers delete the information that they hold about you. Let Incogni do the work for you. Incogni reaches out to data brokers on your behalf, requests your personal data removal, and deals with any objections from their side. It's easy to sign up, and once you do, the entire process is automated. Incogni also keeps you updated about the progress. They're also offering Barbell Medicine listeners a promotional rate to get started. Use promo code Barbell at the link incogni.com/barbell to get an exclusive 60% off an annual plan. That's incogni.com/barbell to get 60% off your annual plan to protect your privacy. Go incognito with Incogni. This podcast is brought to you by Rosetta Stone. As we gather with loved ones this Thanksgiving, consider how learning a new language can enhance your connections and enrich your experiences. You guys know I've been trying to learn French using a competitor, Babbel, before I was endorsing Rosetta Stone. And while I had a good experience with Babbel getting ready for my trip to France, Rosetta Stone offers 12 more languages than Babbel, including many Asian languages that Babbel does not. Additionally, Rosetta Stone is offering 50% off a lifetime membership, which is an incredible deal. Now, Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning program for 30 years, with millions of users and 25 languages offered. It's also available on desktop or as an app, so you can learn anytime, anywhere, and it uses an immersive experience to help you learn the language of your choice, along with the correct accent, using its true accent speech recognition technology. It's like having a personal trainer for your accent. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. Barbell Medicine listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off by visiting rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life by redeeming 50% off at rosettastone.com/today. We're here on Teaching Rounds, talking about program with Dr. Austin Baracchi. Let's actually talk about how to program. All right. So first off here, using this sort of WATER acronym, which again, we might iterate on in the future, let's talk about selecting the weight or the intensity. So in resistance training, we're talking about the weight on the bar, the load, and that really determines the different types of rep ranges that are available to you. So you can think about the difference between 70%, which is about a 15 rep max for most folks, versus 100%, which is a one rep max for everybody. If you're programming only at 100%, you have one rep range that is available to you. It's one rep. Whereas if you program at 70%, you could do 15 reps, 14 reps, 13 reps, et cetera, all the way down to you could do singles at 70%. Okay. So the intensity kind of tells you already what rep ranges are available to you. Okay. Now, there are different sort of adaptations that will be generated by different intensity ranges. I'll say that again. Different fitness adaptations will be generated by different intensity ranges. So intensity determines the types of adaptations that you're going to get. But I don't want people to sort of micromanage this and say, oh, it has to be exactly 75%. No, realistically, we're talking about like a 10% window, 5% window or more. And so when I start thinking about how to conceptualize this, I view this as a sort of continuum, right, of different intensities and reps. So on the sort of low rep, highest intensity end of the spectrum, so a one rep max, 100% 1RM, and things close to that, they're mostly neurological adaptations that are taking place, mostly neurological adaptations. So not only like how quickly can all of your muscles be recruited together to produce force, right? But also relaxation of antagonistic muscles, also coordination, so skill development, and so on, okay? And then if you go to the other end of the spectrum, we'll call it 60% of 1RM, so like a 20 rep max. Most of those, the adaptations that happen down there are related to energy supply and energy buffering. So mitochondrial content, blood capillarization, so capillaries in the muscle, glycogen storage, fat storage in the muscle, all of these things to make the muscle effectively get less fatigued or at least be able to deal with fatigue, for example, and have more energy on board. And again, there are ranges here. And so conceptually speaking, I want you guys to know that intensity in resistance training determines the types of adaptations that you get. With respect to strength in particular, we think that pretty much anything above 70% works about the same for general sort of strength development. But if you're talking about specific strength development, so like a one rep max, well, you're going to want some exposure to stuff more closely related to that test, right? But if you're talking about a five rep max test, for example, or an eight rep max test, there's obviously broader ranges that will work for that. When it comes to hypertrophy training, effectively any intensity is going to work on to some degree. And in fact, you have a much more liberal sort of rep range that you can use, anywhere from like three reps, four reps, all the way up to 30 reps or so. It all is going to work about the same, provided that you're loading the muscle that you want to get bigger and you're getting somewhere close to failure. When I say somewhere close to failure, I'm talking about 4 to 5 reps shy of failure or less, particularly for compound exercises. For isolation exercises, you'd probably want to push that a little bit closer to failure. So that's a story about weight and intensity from a resistance training standpoint. From a conditioning standpoint, it's a similar relationship because we're really talking about like speed or pace, which again determines the distances available to you. If Austin, if you were like, hey, can you program some conditioning stuff for me? I know you're into that now, Dr. Feigenbaum. Why don't you give me some conditioning stuff? And I was like, yeah, dude, run a 400 meter at your 50 meter pace.
Right.
You'd be like,
sprint,
what?
Sprint a marathon.
Yeah, you're like, right. So again, similar relationship and similarly the intensity by which you're doing the conditioning work at will generate different types of adaptations. And so when you start thinking about why am I programming at certain weights or certain paces for conditioning efforts, you're really trying to figure out what sort of adaptations that you want to generate in an individual. And I'll make this case, and I'll repeat this a number of times through the rest of the podcast. I think we want to generate all of the different types of fitness adaptations in individuals who are not involved in a specific sport, thing one, and two, who don't have this broad, long history of training already on board, meaning that this person hasn't already been exercising for, you know, a decade or so and is like thoroughly well-developed. If someone's brand new, yeah, I want to develop maximal strength. Yep, I want to develop strength stamina. Yep, I want to develop strength endurance. I want all of that stuff. I want all of the adaptations. Build a big base of physical development. Same thing with conditioning. I don't want to only be low and slow zone two, although that is a way you could do it. But I still think there's utility in exposing people to this sort of whole spectrum of different intensities to generate at least some of the adaptations that are specific to each sort of intensity range. Does that kind of make sense? Even though you could do it a different way, that's sort of like an idealistic or maybe a utopian sort of view of what this could be.
Yeah, I agree. I'm a big fan of exposure to a range of intensities for maximal development of all of these different attributes. And I think that, you know, I also don't want to give off the implication here that, well, if I do have a specific goal, then I should do that thing and that thing only. Because even in that context, there is some benefit of some variation in exposure. It could be related to the management of fatigue. It could be due to kind of a broader way of developing, you know, around the capacities you're looking for. For example, VO2 max training. Like right now, there's a discussion in the online world about like this 4x4 like workout, you know, interval workout plan as like that's the VO2 max workout. Like, so you just only do that forever. That's no different than some similar paradigms that we've heard about in the strength training realm where it's like this is sufficient and all you ever need to do is fives or something like that, you know. So there's benefit to varying the stimulus, not only for the adaptations you're generating, for fatigue management, for training monotony, psychological enjoyment, all sorts of reasons that we can cite that I would prefer and do when programming for folks, introduce some variation in intensity ranges.
Yep, exactly. I just think as whatever test or performance sort of focused task that you have coming up, so whether it's a powerlifting meet, for example, or a race from a conditioning perspective, as you get closer and closer to that, yes, your training, broadly speaking, should become more specific to that task. But throughout the rest of the season, right? So off season, preseason, and so on, you want to have a sort of diverse range of intensities that you're working with, not only for resistance training, but also conditioning. So again, you have this broad base of physical development that you can draw from when you need to get specific. And if you never need to get specific, great. You don't need to, you know, compromise your training for periods of limited specificity unless that's your personal preference. If you want to do that, that's fine, but you don't have to. I view powerlifting training as sort of this compromise. And people are like, I want to train powerlifting style. I'm like, you sure? Why? But I mean, if you do like squat, bench, deadlift, great. We're homies. We are of cut from the same cloth. I want to do that. But understand that it is a compromise because you are artificially narrowing your exercise selection. You're artificially narrowing the rep work and intensity ranges you're going to be doing a lot of your training in. And for what purpose? If you love powerlifting like I do, which sad to say, that's my affliction. Okay. But if you don't, I wonder where that value system kind of came from and how do we discuss that? All right, so let's move on to the A from this WATER acronym, amount of training or volume, right? So if we agree that intensity, broadly speaking, determines the type of adaptations that people get, volume determines the magnitude of adaptations that people are likely to get. And there's this sort of dose-dependent relationship between amount of exercise or amount of training that people do and the improvement in whatever parameter you're testing. So when it comes to muscular hypertrophy, muscle size, for example, in general, higher volume programs work better than lower volume programs. When it comes to cardiorespiratory fitness, higher amounts of conditioning training generates better improvements in various metrics of endurance performance or cardiorespiratory fitness. Same thing with strength, provided that the rep range is correct, the intensity range is correct for however strength is being assessed, and the exercise selection is correct. In general, doing more training provides a better or bigger improvement in that sort of outcome. The caveat here is is twofold. Caveat number one, I didn't say a linear relationship between training volume and outcomes, meaning that it's not a one-to-one relationship. You do one more set, you get one more strength unit improvement. It's diminishing returns, certainly, but still it's non-zero, okay? Thing two, you have to be prepared for that level of training, that total sort of training load. So that's not just volume, it's volume and intensity and exercise selection and how that looks in the entire program. So if somebody is not yet ready for that amount of training load and they hear this podcast, they're like, well, just got to do more. I love the enthusiasm, but it may be too much too soon. And so best case scenario, it takes you a few weeks to sort of acclimate to that level of training load, and then you're off to the races. Sometimes you see that in hypertrophy training, like no muscle growth happens for a few weeks, and then 4 or 5 weeks in, ooh, starting to get a little signal that the muscles are growing. And sometimes you see that in strength training too. Worst case scenario is it's way too much, way too soon, plus or minus some bad luck, overuse injury. And that would obviously be bad for sort of fitness adaptations if you were unable to train. So again, intensity maybe determines the type of adaptations that you're getting, and volume determines the magnitude of adaptations. And so I think for a good starting point for most folks, particularly individuals who are not currently exercising, the current training guidelines, exercise guidelines for Americans are a great place to start. It's twice weekly resistance training for all the major muscle groups at an intensity level that makes you feel kind of hard at the end for a few sets. Usually between 2 to 5 sets is kind of when this has actually been implemented. And that's twice per week resistance training and at least about 2.5 hours of conditioning per week. That's a sort of general sort of recommendation for a minimum level of exercise for health purposes. But when you start tacking on performance and performance outcomes like strength, muscular hypertrophy, cardiorespiratory fitness above and beyond what's just needed for health, so to speak, then the amount of exercise that's needed to do that to maximize those sort of outcomes becomes much, much higher. Austin, can you imagine if you were, you know, I want to be an endurance athlete now. You just flip the script. You're like, look, I've deadlifted 750 freaking pounds. I'm strong. Now I want to run a marathon, right? Can you imagine the difference in training time per week that you would have to dedicate to running a marathon versus training for a low 700, mid 700 pound deadlift? Like, how many hours per week were you training to lift that weight?
Yeah, a lot.
But yeah, I would still say it's probably, 10 hours a week maybe to lift that weight?
Yeah, I mean, I guess if I narrowed it down to just the preparation that was necessary for the deadlift and excluded my other training, bench training, stuff like that, it actually probably wasn't a huge amount. When I take cumulative all of the resistance training for all the different things I was training for, it was a decent amount. But yeah, just for that task, comparatively to the amount of volume that would be necessary for a conditioning type effort like that, having done that type of conditioning training before as a mid-distance swimmer, the conditioning training was actually far more. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And especially to have a similar level performance in that conditioning event. So people say, oh, you don't need to train that hard to run a 5K. It's like, well, yeah, that's probably true for a good swath of the population, particularly healthy individuals. But to run whatever the comparative 5K time is to a 700-pound deadlift, that's a lot
good.
Of training hours. Yeah, if you want to be good, it's going to take some time. And so, yeah, if the current minimal exercise guidelines really requires something like a 3.5 hour per week investment, but performance sort of outcomes are going to require far more than that. And so there are no biological free lunches. You got to get to give, you got to pay to play. And I don't see a way of getting more out of less as people become more and more trained. People, invariably life comes up and, hey, how do I get the most out of being able to train 2 or 3 days a week? Well, look, I can generate a program that I think is going to be putting your best foot forward. But the reality is most people probably would benefit from having more time available to exercise. Do you feel like it's a fair statement?
Yeah, totally.
Okay. All right. So that's the A in the water acronym. Now we're going to move to T, type. Okay. So we're talking about modalities and exercise selection. So we talked about modes earlier, broadly speaking, two different types of exercise modes, resistance training and aerobic training or conditioning. So resistance training involves moving the muscles of the body, creating force against a load or weight. The weight may be external or internal to the individual. So it could be barbell, like external, or body weight, so internal sort of load that you're producing force against. Similarly, muscle contractions can be dynamic, where the muscles lengthen. It's called an eccentric muscle contraction. Or they can shorten. So that's a concentric muscle contraction in a coordinated fashion, like in the squat. So on the way down, your muscles are eccentrically lengthening, and on the way up, they're shortening. It's concentric contraction. Or alternatively, the muscles could stay in a static sort of position. They don't lengthen or shorten. That's called isometric exercises. And you might have done that in like a wall sit or a plank or something like that. So that's resistance training as a modality. And we want people on average to be doing at least twice weekly resistance training, right? So from a programmer perspective, that's like the sort of minimum dose that we'd want people to have for health. And then again, for performance, you'd want more of that. The second mode, again, is aerobic training or conditioning. This is an umbrella term that includes physical activities designed to improve endurance, which is the ability of muscles to sustain repeated force production, primarily through the support of the cardiorespiratory system for a relatively long period of time. This is running, cycling, swimming, erging, galloping, prancer-sizing, things of that nature. And as far as how much of this we want people to do, again, it's about 2.5 hours per week, ideally spread out over most days. That's 20 to 30 minutes per day. And those are the two major modes or types of exercise that we want people to be doing. Got to lift some weights, got to do some conditioning. Now, within this sort of category is exercise selection. And the two major principles here by how you go about selecting exercises. One is going to be the SED principle, which is an acronym that stands for the specificity of adaptation to the imposed demand. And the second is going to be preferences. So Austin, actually, I'm going to do this in reverse. Why don't you start out and start talking about exercise selection preferences? And I'll give you a sort of premise here. The way that I break down exercise selection into workable categories that from a coaching perspective I can use to sort of go through my thought process here is I break down exercises into four major categories of movement. So a squat pattern, a push or press pattern, a pull or row pattern is number three, and four is going to be a sort of hinge or deadlift pattern. All right. So when you talk about preferences, we've made it each one of those categories. And again, we're training for like general health to start out with. And maybe you can talk to a performance minded individual. How do you go about selecting an exercise based on preferences there?
Yeah. So this involves quite a bit of conversation with the person, because part of it, in order to have preferences, they would probably have had some sort of prior experience. And so I want to learn about what that experience was and how that informs their current preferences. So what have you done in the past? What did you like about it? What didn't you like about it? And that might help me to narrow down, you know, the types of movements within those categories that I might select. A different scenario in an outright beginner might be, I have no experience with any of these things. And so I'm just, you're the coach, in which case we kind of have free rein here. Now, as we mentioned before, we believe there to be benefit from variation, not only in the intensity of stimulus, but also in the exercise selection. And we like to introduce this relatively early on as a way to start building that base of physical movement competency and you know, trying to train everyone to some extent like an athlete, even if they might not be coming in as an athlete, even if they might not have athletic aspirations. Conceptualizing them as such or trying to develop them in that way, we think is a useful kind of paradigm to operate in which case the next question from there is going to be, what do you have access to? Because it's going to matter whether they are training in a black iron gym with barbells, or whether they're training in a commercial gym, or whether they're training, you know, at home, or whatever the context is. And so that's going to be the next kind of filter for how we go about selecting movements based on the equipment availability. And sometimes we have to get awfully creative with folks, especially if they're, you know, trying to manage something at home. I've counseled folks on doing, you know, especially like an older person who's trying to get going with something at home, and all they have access to is a gallon of milk, and I'm giving them do chair sit to stands to train some form of like a loaded goblet squat at home. But hey, if they've done nothing prior and they're, you know, frail and maybe sarcopenic, then being able to go from not doing that to doing that is life-changing. So I think that those are the main things that I think about is, what are their preferences based on prior experience if they have it? If they don't have preferences, then okay, proceed to step two. What equipment or available access do you have? And then that kind of gives me the limits of the sandbox that I have to play in. And then I go about selecting a couple different variations within there. If they have no specific goals, then it doesn't matter too much. I definitely want to train the whole body in some capacity, but I'm not going to absolutely insist rigidly on that. You must absolutely include this one particular movement if I'm otherwise training the whole body with the movements that I select within that sandbox.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, as somebody's goals become more and more specific, their constraints sort of narrow, right? But if they don't have very specific barbell performance related goals, then you're effectively almost open-ended outside of, like, broadly speaking, you want to do some sort of squat pattern, you want to do some sort of pressing pattern, some sort of rowing pattern, some sort of hinge pattern multiple times per week to train all the major muscle groups of the body. You can sprinkle in additional isolation exercises that would fall under those purviews as well. But the person's preferences on how to select a specific exercise, what I'm hearing you say, almost supersedes all of that stuff. Like, if they want to train with machines versus barbells, great. They want to train with dumbbells versus barbells, great. Kettlebells versus, you know, what? There are other things that are going to become, you know, inventions. If they want to use a pulley-based training for all their stuff, you can figure out ways around that. You might have to get creative, but it is what it is. But that's what I'm hearing you say, though, is their preferences kind of supersede any sort of personal bias you have for your favorite movements.
Yeah, in the absence of very crystallized goals at the front, as you mentioned, or very crystallized limitations at the forefront, then yeah, we have a lot of different options. And then the limitation from there might be, hey, what's the scalability or the trainability of this particular preference they have? If they're like, oh, I only want to do like band training or something, it's like, okay, well, that we can get going with that. But, you know, after a certain point, it's going to be maybe kind of difficult to keep progressing this over time to the extent that I would expect you to respond to this training. And so then, but maybe we've gotten the ball rolling, we built some momentum, maybe they're feeling better, maybe they're motivated, excited to explore other kind of movement styles or other training implements or something like that. But I'll take whatever buy-in I can up front if we're just getting going in this process.
Yep. Yep, same. And so when I start thinking about, okay, going down the rabbit hole further, do people need specific exercises and when would be a good use case for those? And if they have specific goals relating, again, to barbell related performance and or like other outcomes regarding muscle size, then yeah, I'm just going to leverage the said principle and its predictive potential for training adaptations. And what I mean by that is, again, the said acronym stands for the specificity of adaptation to the imposed demand. That means that when you do a squat, for example, you expect most of the adaptations, the largest amount of adaptations that you're going to get from performing that exercise are going to be specific to the squat. It doesn't mean you get zero adaptations to other exercises, particularly those involving the legs, like the deadlift, for example, or other types of squats, like the front squat, for example. It's just that they're are relatively less than the type of squat that you actually performed. Same thing with doing some sort of isolation exercise, like a biceps curl. The main muscle that is going to be developed through a variation of the biceps curl are going to be the biceps, and then the next is going to be muscles of the forearm, and then further on the muscles of the hand, and then you keep getting further away. There's some sort of training effect. It just gets smaller and smaller and smaller, the less specifically that exercise actually targets either that muscle group or that particular movement pattern. And so when I think about specificity of exercise, I think about a handful of different characteristics. I think about the range of motion. I think about the muscle lengths. I think about the overall movement pattern, the movement velocity, right? So if someone who like wants to be better at a high velocity sport, so running, jumping, sprinting, punching, kicking, throwing, or whatever, they're going to have to do some high velocity movements in training. And I need to pick exercises that allow them to do that. Could it be Olympic lifting? Sure. But it could also be a regular barbell movement, just loaded at a weight that allows the person to move quickly. On the other hand, if someone's a powerlifter and they're like, should I be doing speed work? And I don't know that why that was the voice that I just picked up on that. I would say no, because I don't think that there's a relationship between high velocity force production and your maximal strength in somebody who's already training for maximal strength. It seems like a missed opportunity to train additionally in a specific way for your sport, which you've declared as powerlifting. So again, when I think about type of exercise and broadly thinking about what are the lifting elements, what are the conditioning elements, and then how I'm picking specific sort of exercises, I'm thinking about the said principle. And also the person's preferences. For people who are new to training, again, I want a broad base of physical development to take place through the training program. So I'm thinking variants of each sort of movement pattern, meaning it's unlikely I'm going to have somebody back squat multiple times per week if they're otherwise untrained. I might have them, if they prefer, to do a back squat once per week. But for the other sort of training sessions, I'm going to do a squat type pattern that's different. So it could be a unilateral exercise, like a split squat. It could be a front squat. It could be a leg press. It could be a hack squat, pendulum squat. I'm doing something different. And that's basically a way to hedge my bets for motor learning, right? And also just making sure that all of the muscles that I'm trying to load are done so, it's performed in a way that is not isolated to one particular movement pattern. It's more spread out, which I think helps development. Does that kind of make sense to you?
Yeah. And I think that, again, the counter could be from somebody who says, yeah, well, if you were to have them squat every session up front, they would probably get stronger faster. And we would say, well, they would get stronger at the squat faster. And how that pans out and how that translates into their outcomes, be it related to health or even indeed their squat performance 15 years later, I think is not necessarily going to be heavily impacted based on whether you did a more rigid, highly specific program up front versus introducing more variation up front. And we are big fans of variation, not only for, you know, enjoyment and buy-in for people who express that, but also in terms of reducing the risk of overuse aches and pains, which are quite common, particularly when people do the same thing over and over and over again and rapidly increase the load. We see that quite a bit.
Yeah, I'd actually predict that if you took identical twins, right, and one person followed a program where they squatted 3 times per week for 1 year, right? And then the other identical twin did squats once per week and then 2 other closely related variations, but not exactly the back squat for a whole year. And then you tested their 1 rep max leg press at the end of the year, right? I don't suspect that there would be any difference in leg press performance. In fact, I'd probably hedge my bets towards the person who's doing a variety of different leg exercises, right? The whole point is that when you're sort of predicting outcomes, the only thing I can say with this is that the person who squatted every day, every training session only squatting, they're probably more efficient at doing that specific type of squat at the end of 1 year. But how does that transfer to other sort of non-squat related movements, like general strength development? They're probably behind, right? Probably behind. And just doing one exercise that happens to be heavier, for example, doesn't make you stronger at everything else. It just makes you potentially stronger at that one specific movement.
Yeah, this also came out in some recent research that was looking at adaptations in the context of conditioning training, where they looked at, for example, sprint interval training versus kind of more lower intensity, steadier state type work. And in the same way, the high intensity stuff had the best outcomes in the short term. So doing the hard stuff, increasing the weight really quickly, doing the sprint interval training will give you the biggest bang for your buck, for example, in your VO2 max over a course of like 6 weeks or something like that. But when you zoom out and look over a much longer time span, that benefit drops off pretty significantly compared with more variation and indeed using other styles of training as well. And so that's kind of the way that we're looking at this. It's like, it's easy to make a case for higher intensity lifting training if your outcomes are very short term. But we are not as concerned with short term outcomes because nobody really cares how much you can lift after 6 weeks of training or 2 months of training or 3 months of training. When we are talking about, you know, the cumulative lifelong exposure to resistance exercise, the cumulative lifelong exposure to conditioning training. So I care about where you're at after 20, 30 plus years of doing this, not necessarily after 6, 12, 18, 24 weeks, because that all fundamentally doesn't matter that much.
Yeah, you're not that strong anyway, so who cares? Yeah. All right, last part of the WATER acronym, that's going to be effort and regulation, so proximity to failure. And the way I'll discuss this is with 3 different specific aims from training, so strength, muscular hypertrophy, and cardiorespiratory fitness. So from a strength perspective, I think most of the individual's training should happen between RPE 6 and 8. With some deviation above that a little bit and sometimes some deviation below that, but the bulk of the work should be between RP 6 and 8. So kind of hard, but not maximal, but certainly not easy. Does that kind of make sense to you?
Yeah, and I think this is also borne out by research looking at the velocity loss kind of analysis where they take 2 groups and they have them train a little bit closer to failure to where their sets get more grindy and hard at the end versus those whose bar speed maybe stays a little bit faster. It still falls a little bit, but not quite as grindy at the end. And people who grind less, tended to have actually better strength outcomes. And that raises the question of why. That might feel counterintuitive for people, but why are you grinding so hard at the end of your sets? What makes those reps so slow and hard? You're not producing very much force anymore. And if the goal of strength training is to increase the capacity to produce force, we should train in a way that involves producing high amounts of force, not low amounts of force, which is what we see at the end of really hard, grindy sets. So while it might feel like in your gut, what Colbert used to refer to as the truth, the truthiness of it, it might just feel to you to be true that like going that hard all the way, to, it has to make you stronger. Turns out, yeah, not to be the case.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, moving on to hypertrophy. This is kind of like a split in sort of what I think is useful from a proximity to failure recommendation. So for compound multi-joint exercises for hypertrophy, I still think that same RP 6 to 8 sort of range is useful. And for isolation exercises, I would rather bump that up to RP 7 to 10, meaning you can go all the way to failure or just shy of that. And I think that tends to work a little bit better, particularly with isolation exercises, particularly in individuals who are newer to training. But yeah, the evidence on compound exercises taken all the way to failure, I don't know that it's worth the extra fatigue, because I think that hypertrophy related outcomes are more related to volume rather than, you know, getting one rep closer to failure, particularly from compound exercises. But for isolation exercises, I just don't care. And here's why I don't care. It's not because I don't value some of the show muscles or whatever. It's just because when you're doing an isolation exercise, the amount of muscle mass that you're using, the range of motion that you're using compared to a compound exercise, this sort of systemic stress that you're experiencing is so much less in a biceps curl compared to a back squat, for example. It, to me, I'm like, it's worth the risk, you know, whereas taking a squat all the way to failure, you know, doesn't mean you should never do that. And that's like terrible training. It's just there's the stakes are higher when it comes to a compound exercise, particularly a free weight compound exercise compared to an isolation exercise. And I'm not really talking about injury risk per se, although if you did it too often, sure, there's an argument point there. But yeah, broadly speaking, compound exercises, RP 6 to 8, strength and hypertrophy. And then for isolation exercises, maybe we bump that up to 7 to 10. Does that make sense to you?
I think that's fair.
Okay. And to the surprise of absolutely no one, for cardiorespiratory fitness, my sort of RPE or subjective sort of rating of effort during conditioning is going to be a little bit wider. And so the way that I apply this to the sort of 5-zone model of conditioning, and we've talked about that on a whole podcast series, and we've actually got a free heart rate calculator for zones on our website. I'll link that in the description below. Zone 1, I'm calling that RP 2 to 3. Sometimes that's called the active recovery zone. Our zone 2, which has gotten a lot of airplay recently, is somewhere in that RP 4 to 6 range. Some people call it RP 3 to 5. And then you're asking, what's the scale that they're using to like rate this to RP? And they're like, I don't know. And I'm like, yeah, hey, same here. Because it's all kind of made up. We're using these sort of subjective measurements of exertion or how hard the effort is to correlate with other physiological variables like heart rate, like blood lactate levels, like respiratory rate, things of that nature. So it's all kind of made up on some level. And I think these can be useful for actually like doing this in a rudimentary way. But if you have a heart rate monitor, I would just use that. And RP can be useful secondary to that. So yeah. Zone 1, RP 2 to 3, zone 2, RP 4 to 6, or 3 to 5, 3 to 6, that's all fine. Zone 3, I'm thinking more RP 6 to 7. Zone 4, that would be considered like tempo work, for example. Threshold work, as you're getting closer to your sort of anaerobic threshold, that's going to be RP 8, RP 8 to 9. And then zone 5, which is like above your VO2 max or at your level of VO2 max, RP 9 and higher. If that scale is useful for you, cool. But I think the heart rate stuff can be useful, particularly for folks who maybe don't have a long background in conditioning, and they're kind of like, they feel even more uncomfortable using an RPE scale there. You could use the breathlessness scale. So one tool that I've had people use is try to recite the Pledge of Allegiance while they're doing a conditioning effort. If you can complete the Pledge of Allegiance without getting breathless, you're probably in zone 1 or below. And if you do start to get breathless, you're probably nearing that change between zone 2 and zone 3. So that's a tool you can use. It's not perfect, but if somebody's like, look, I don't have a heart rate monitor, the RPE thing doesn't make any sense to me, I need something else. You could also use this idea, this thing where you can speak in short sentences, but not sing. It's another way to kind of make this a little rudimentary. But overall, I think that most people should be doing the bulk of their cardio training in zone 2, about 80% of that, zone 1 and zone 2, about 80%, whereas the rest of it 20% could be higher intensity. We did an episode recently on high intensity interval training. Would recommend you to listen to that if you're interested in high intensity interval training. I don't think that training distribution matters that much for folks who are just meeting the guidelines. In fact, I don't really care how you accomplish those guidelines at what intensity level. I think as you start to do more and more higher volumes of conditioning training and performance becomes more important to you, then the training distribution probably matters more.
Yeah, I agree. I was going to say that there are like large error bars around that 80-20 thing, because that would trigger some like endurance coaches. There are people who training and performing at very high levels who are going to have a radically different distribution. And then for people who are not training at a very high level or who do not have very discrete goals, where the error bars around that actually matter a lot less in terms of what your personal distribution looks like outside of preferences and your tolerance. So you're not running yourself into the ground, or as you said earlier, till the wheels are falling off, to make sure that you can still recover, tolerate that, and do your strength training.
Yep, agreed. All right, so let's wrap this up. But before we do, in the future teaching rounds for the Barbell Medicine Plus subscribers, we will discuss other topics certainly on programming. So how to measure progress, how to troubleshoot training, how to address setbacks and rehab from injuries, programming applications in the context of certain medical conditions, and more. So if you like this type of content, all right, please consider becoming a Barbell Medicine Plus subscriber. It really helps support our work here at Barbell Medicine and what we want to do. And then, you know, you don't have to listen to ads like this. All right, let's summarize this. Programming is all of the structured physical activity components that an individual participates in over a given period of time. The main variables to consider when programming are reflected in the acronym WATER, which stands for weight, amount, type, effort, and regulation. For resistance training, we recommend picking an intensity that selects for the adaptations that are specific to the person's goals, if there's good reason to. There are a range of viable intensities, and generally speaking, the more of it you do, the more progress you make, provided you can tolerate it. As far as the types of exercises that you should pick, well, again, they should be specific to the test or the way progress is being measured, again, only if necessary. Otherwise, we would recommend a wide range of different exercises and a wide range of different intensities to build a broad base of physical development. Regarding effort and regulation, most of the training should be done in the RPE 6 to 8 range, with some exposure to higher RPE ranges for isolation exercises, or for those who are struggling with precision using RPE, so that's doing sort of an RPE audit, and or those who have an upcoming test or meet. Other forms of autoregulation can also work. For conditioning, we recommend first hitting the guideline minimums of 150 minutes per week. At this volume, intensity is less important, and pretty much all things that count as exercise are likely to work, save for perhaps only sprint work. Now, higher volumes tend to develop higher levels of cardiorespiratory fitness, which necessitates consideration of intensity and subsequent fatigue. For this reason, we favor an intensity distribution of about 80% of moderate intensity, that's zones 1 and zone 2, and 20% of higher intensity work. That includes other higher zones, zones 3, 4, and 5. As in strength training, true all-out or absolute maximal efforts should be relatively few and far between. We also recommend using a collaborative and iterative approach to programming, adjusting the training program based on how the person responds to it. For more information and for a more detailed view on how we think about programming, how we actually go about doing it, would recommend picking up our low fatigue ebook. It's sort of my magnus opus for programming as it stands right now, and I still am really proud of that. Dr. Baraki, anything else you want to add to folks about programming here on this teaching rounds?
Not today. Seems like there'll be more to come.
There we go. All right. Well, this has been the Barbell Medicine Podcast special. Shout out to Dr. Austin Baraki for joining us here on Teaching Rounds Programming Edition. Before you guys go anywhere, please leave us a 5-star rating and a review. It really helps drive traffic to our podcast so we can keep bringing you all the latest nuance in health and fitness. From everyone here at Barbell Medicine, I'm Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. We'll catch you next week and every week right here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast. Hi, I'm Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum, founder of Barbell Medicine, and over the last 10 plus years in business, we've built a team of amazing professionals that includes physicians, physical therapists, dietitians, and strength coaches that are available to help you reach your goals. Whether it's strength and muscle gain, weight management, or recovering from an injury, we have some of the best coaches in the game and have worked with people from all walks of life. From teens to grandparents and beginners to elite level athletes, our experienced team of professionals work together to meet you where you're at and give you what you need to succeed. That's the Barbell Medicine difference. If you're not sure exactly what you need, take the quiz linked in the description below or send us an email, support@barbellmedicine.com, and we'll get you sorted. From all of us here at Barbell Medicine, we look forward to hearing from you. We'd love to help.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.